From the studios of the Mayo Clinic News Network, this is Mayo Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you.
Welcome everyone to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Varicose veins, those swollen, twisted veins that you can see just under the skin, usually they're just a cosmetic concern, but in some cases can cause pain and discomfort, which does require treatment.
We'll hear about varicose vein treatment options from a Mayo Clinic expert who also shares his fascinating personal story.
And when I was a young surgeon in Budapest, that was the only way to attend medical meetings, get an exit visa as a magician.
Also on the program, we'll discuss the findings of a recent study on women, antidepressants, and sexual dysfunction.
And the common condition hypothyroidism, or underactive thyroid. It's easily treatable. We'll learn how.
All that, along with this week's health and medical news, right after this. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Varicose veins, you know, those gnarled, enlarged veins that usually show up in your legs and your feet? Well, that's because standing and walking upright increases the pressure of the veins in your lower body. And for a lot of people, varicose veins and spider veins, which are a common mild variation of varicose veins, they're simply a cosmetic concern. You don't like the way they look. And I don't know of anybody who thinks those big, ugly veins are that nice.
If only we did.
Yeah.
For other people, varicose veins can cause aching pain and discomfort, and sometimes varicose veins lead to more serious problems. Here to discuss treatment options for varicose veins, and maybe a little bit more than that, Mayo Clinic vascular surgeon Dr. Peter Glavitsky. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Glavitsky. Good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here with you.
And, you know, we're lucky to have you here because you're sort of in the twilight of your career. And didn't you just tell me that this is your last day or tomorrow is?
This is my last day.
Oh, wow.
It's a good thing we got him booked.
What a send-off. Yeah.
All right. Well, in all of your career, what have you learned about varicose veins? And is that the number one thing people ask you about?
Well, this is a very frequent thing that people are asking me about because varicose veins are one of the most prevalent medical disorders. There are more than 25 million American adults who have varicose veins.
25 million?
25 million.
What percent are women?
And it's a little bit more frequent in women than in men. In younger people, it is more frequent in women. In older people, it's more frequent in men.
Is it just a cosmetic concern, or is there actually a problem?
It is frequently a cosmetic problem because, as you said, there is a spectrum of problems from spider veins, teleangiectasia, to varicose veins, to advanced chronic venous disease, which includes, unfortunately, venous ulcers, which lead to pain, disability, loss of working days.
You know, I think another concern for people who have enlarged varicose veins, they're concerned about a blood clot. Is that a complication of varicose veins or no?
Blood clots are complications of large varicose veins, and there are two types of blood clots. One is what we call superficial thrombophlebitis, and that is more frequent in varicose veins. And the other one is deep vein blood clots that have a lot of other etiologies, but varicose veins is among them.
But you don't have the potential complications with the superficial, with the clots in the varicose veins that you could potentially have with a thrombus or a clot in the deeper vein, right? Where it could potentially go to the lung and actually take your life.
Actually, you do, but it's rare.
Yeah.
But some advanced superficial phlebitis, we treat it like they were deep vein thrombosis, really just to prevent a life-threatening blood clot in the lungs.
And how have you changed in your treatment of varicose veins?
Oh, treatment has been revolutionized in the last decade or so.
What did you do in the beginning of your practice when someone had varicose veins?
Well, open surgery has been and is, continues to be a major part of our treatment of venous disease. And that's what we have been doing from the beginning, surgically remove varicose veins, either what we call a phlebectomy, which are small incisions to remove individual varicose veins, or a procedure that is a little bit more invasive than the currently used techniques. It's called the stripping.
Mm. Remember the two brothers, the two vascular surgeon brothers, wasn't it the Lofgren brothers? That's basically all they did, wasn't it? Strip veins day in.
The Lofgren brothers and T.T. Myers, they really ran one of the world's largest vein clinic or vein center here in Rochester, Minnesota. But it's interesting to see that the Mayo brothers actually were very interested in varicose veins, and they published close to 300 varicose vein operation as early as 1906. They even invented a certain type of vein stripper. So the Mayo brothers were very much involved in venous disease. And believe it or not, the very first operation at St. Mary's Hospital was a patient with varicose vein surgery.
Is that right? Yeah. And then, back in those days, you were doing vein stripping, or actually removing the vein through incisions.
Yes, but actually the stripper that the Mayo brothers invented, Charles Mayo specifically, enabled you to make two small incisions, and with the help of this stripper, remove the entire vein that was under the skin between these two incisions. So it was actually revolutionary at that time.
We're bouncing back and forth between the beginning of his practice and what the Mayo brothers were doing. Those two things, not at the same time. Let's just be clear about that, right?
That is correct.
I mean, you've been here a long time, but not back when the Mayo brothers were working.
That is correct. And actually, the revolutionary change in the last decade or two decades have been the minimally invasive endovascular treatment of varicose veins with laser and radio frequency.
So that's how people are treated now?
This is how people are treated now. It is called endovenous thermal ablations.
And tell us about that. How do you do
that?
Well,
this is done actually as an office procedure. It is done without an incision, just percutaneously with a...
Through the skin,
just with the, through a small catheter. You insert the catheter into the saphenous vein, which is the main vein of the superficial system that is frequently the only vein that's responsible for the varicosities. But of course, the branch varicosities need treatment as well. But the saphenous vein treatment is done with this percutaneous technique without an incision under what we call tumescent local anesthesia. And these veins are sealed by the heat of the catheter that is inserted.
And they're burned?
And they're burned. That's exactly okay. The right way. That's why it's called endovenous thermal ablation.
Thermal, meaning heat. Yeah.
Meaning heat. So the laser fiber warms up to close to 1,000 degrees, and the radio frequency fiber is heated up to 120 degrees centigrade.
Should everyone get their varicose veins treated, or is it just for cosmetic purposes you'd do that?
Of course not everyone should have their varicose vein treatment treated. I think there is a great debate, and we just recently participated in a great Medicare debate with MedCAC, which is an agency that actually advises reimbursement for Medicare patients, because there are 25 million Americans who have varicose veins. Now, if you treated everybody, that would really be such a huge expense that the country's healthcare system couldn't afford it. So there are specific indications to treat patients with varicosities and those who have more advanced chronic venous insufficiency.
And the for sure indications for treatment are?
And for sure indications are symptomatic varicose veins.
So they're painful.
They are painful, although again, the pain is something that is subjective. So the real for sure indications are those that have advanced disease with visible evidence of more advanced chronic venous insufficiency, which includes skin changes, edema, history of phlebitis, history of bleeding, and venous ulcers.
All right, and edema is swelling. Well, it's so good to know that you've made so much progress in the field of varicose veins. Nice job. You can retire.
We've been talking with Dr. Peter Glavitsky about treatment for varicose veins. We're going to take a short break.
When we come back, we'll switch gears and we'll hear about Dr. Glavitsky's personal journey, how magic led to medicine, or at least had a major part in it. Dr. Peter Glavitsky coming up.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
We are with vascular surgeon Dr. Peter Glavitsky on his penultimate day at the Mayo Clinic. And Peter, tomorrow is the last day, but you have one of the greatest stories ever with regard to not only where you grew up, but how you got into medicine and how you got to the Mayo Clinic. Can you share that with us? This could be your last opportunity.
Well, I went to a medical school in Budapest, and there are a lot of reasons why I went to medicine. And one of the most important is that my father was a tremendous role model for me. And already at age six, I declared it in the family that I would like to be a professor of surgery.
Is that what your father was, a professor?
My father was actually an internist and a neurologist, but he had a good friend who was a surgeon. And so I wanted to be a little bit different than my father, but indeed stay in the profession.
But at the age of six.
You were 6 years old.
That's right. And then, you know, things went well, and I got into high school and medical school. And interestingly, on the way, I met a colleague of my father who was an amateur magician. And he gave us a magic show, and I tried to do some tricks, and he kind of realized that I am not only interested, but I have a certain talent. So he became my mentor. And at age 14, I participated in a Star Search television competition in Hungary that was called The Hungarian Idol. And I got first prize.
Oh, my goodness. Do you remember what you won for first place?
Well, the first prize was that we were allowed to attend a World Youth Festival in Finland, Helsinki.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I could perform for an international audience.
And you were how old then?
Age 14.
14. Okay.
And then I got into the medical school, and I certainly, you know, I was looking for what's the area in surgery that I liked, and there was one position open at the cardiovascular clinic, and the vascular surgeon was a good friend of my father, and actually he took me, and you know, after 2 weeks I really loved vascular surgery. So I did my residency, and then I got a scholarship to Paris. And I worked with a very famous professor, Professor Servelle, who a couple of times during the year I spent there disappeared and came back and told us about his trip. And I asked him, "Where did you go, sir?" He said, "I went to the Mayo Clinic." He said, "Why
From
did
Paris.
You go to the Mayo Clinic?"
Yeah.
He said, "Monsieur, the Mayo Clinic is number one in the world." So I thought, if the Mayo Clinic is number one in the world, what am I doing in Paris?
That's right. Why wouldn't I be there?
Rochester is so much better than Paris.
And this is how I actually ultimately got to Rochester. I was just searching, I found a physician, Dr. Alexander Schirger, who had some Hungarian relatives and really took me under his wings. He got one of his patients came up with a scholarship, the Bestor brothers, and I became the first Bestor fellow. And exactly 35 years ago, in July of 1981, I started here as a research fellow.
The Bestor brothers, I know them also. They're from Illinois, right?
That's correct.
Geneseo.
That's right.
And they actually provided the money to allow you to come here to do additional training.
That's right.
And Dr. Schirger was your mentor.
That's
a great
right.
guy.
Yeah.
Amazing
story. What about the physician in Paris, your teacher in Paris? Was he impressed when you said, "I'm going to Mayo Clinic"?
He didn't know it at that time, but he certainly was impressed 10 years later when I met him at a meeting. I said, "Well, where are you, Peter?" He didn't remember my last name.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well, I'm at Mayo Clinic." "You are at the Mayo Clinic." And since that time, I was his most favorite student.
Did you, has there ever been a chance when you've used magic in your practice of medicine?
I actually
He's used some of it in my room, actually.
Has he really?
He's got some of the best hands I've ever seen. And every once in a while, I would get into trouble with a blood vessel, and Peter was always there.
So my patients know it. My door card has a magic hand and a top hat. And interesting enough, when I became a named professor. I got the professorship that was made in honor of Dr. Allie Beers, who, as you know, not only was a world-famous surgeon, but he was a very gifted magician.
What?
So we found
Are magicians and surgeons the one and the same here?
We found each other in magic, and actually we performed together with Dr. Beers at one of the meetings of the Minnesota Surgical Society.
Oh my gosh.
And that, you know,
launched your magic career.
Magic helped me all along my life, you know, everywhere.
It's pretty amazing. So tell us what you're going to do now. I mean, you retire tomorrow from your surgical practice from the Mayo Clinic. You've been here, what, 30, how many years?
35 years 35. And 29 on the staff. And I became the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Vascular Surgery, which is the main journal of vascular surgeons and the Society for Vascular Surgery. And that is something that I'm going to do, hopefully, in the next 6 years.
I'm imagining you down on the Peace Plaza or in local coffee shops performing magic. Are you going to be doing more magic now that you're retiring?
And I am sure that I'm going to do some more magic. I am a member of the Magic Castle, which is the largest private magic club in Hollywood, California. So when we travel to Los Angeles, we always visit the castle. And there are a lot of other projects.
So tell me about the last 35 years practicing medicine here at Mayo Clinic. What are some of the things that you're going to remember, maybe fondly or maybe not so fondly?
Let's
go with the fondly.
Every day is a pleasure to work here. That's the way I can sum it up. This is an unbelievable place, you know, where indeed people who are devoted to this profession, they should come and practice here. Dr. Shives and myself, we have worked together, you know, many times, and together we are so much better than just one of us.
Was this a hard decision for you?
Of course it was a hard decision. It's always a hard decision. And, you know, everybody asks me, my patients are crying. They are asking me why I'm retiring. Yeah. But the fact is, I'm 68 years old, and you must make a decision. There is no right time, but I prefer to retire at a time when I think I am the best, and when I say that I retire, not when Dr. Shives asks me, how come you haven't retired yet?
Now, I always love hearing the stories about how you got from Hungary to Paris to here, and you've continued to do the magic, which has been a hobby of yours for so long. How many magic shows you do a year, do you think?
Well, obviously, I do much less now than what I used to do, but I used to be pretty good, and I got a second prize at the World Championship of Magic in 1973 in Paris. and when I was a young surgeon in Budapest, that was the only way to come out to attend medical meetings, to arrange a magic show, get an exit visa as a magician. Because as a physician, they didn't let me leave. It was a communist country.
Yeah. So you used magic to go to medical conferences?
Absolutely. Every time. Every time.
Wow. Dr. Peter Glavitsky, congratulations on your retirement, magician and master vascular surgeon. Really enjoyed having you on the program. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio, is there a connection between women, antidepressants, and sexual dysfunction?
And later on the show, we'll learn about the common condition hypothyroidism. Coming up, the latest health and medical news with Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Vivian Williams. An article in the journal Pediatrics reports that more parents are refusing to vaccinate their kids because they think vaccines may be unnecessary. Mayo Clinic experts say routine vaccines are safe and effective at preventing diseases, including seasonal illnesses such as the flu. This year, the nasal spray form of the flu vaccine is not available. Mayo Clinic pediatrician Dr. Bob Jacobson says even without the mist, parents should get their children vaccinated.
The vaccine in the past had good study reports showing that it worked better than the injectable. But after the pandemic, studies that have come out since have shown that it hasn't worked as well as the injectable, in many cases failed completely.
He and his team know that shots can be scary, so they developed ways to make getting the vaccine a little less painful. Well, how can they make the shot less of an issue? Well, distraction and a spray coolant to numb the skin. Sure, shots can be scary and painful, but
everyone still needs to get the flu vaccine every year
to protect you and the people around you from catching the flu. And in other news, sleep is really important for school kids. They need plenty of it to perform well in school. After a summer of staying up late and then sleeping in, many kids are out of their school year bedtime routines. Pediatric neurologist and sleep specialist Dr. Suresh Kodigal says most school-age children must sleep from 8 to 9 hours every night to be at their best. He says children should work back into a school year sleep schedule gradually, starting about a week or two before that first bell rings. Now, Dr. Kodigal offers these tips to help kids get the sleep they need for a productive school year. Wake kids up 30 minutes earlier every few days as school approaches. Turn off electronics 30 minutes to an hour before bedtime. Temporarily avoid or shorten naps to help children be sleepy at night, and make sure the bed is used for sleep only. Good sleep habits for a great school year. For the Mayo Clinic News Network, I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Tracy, 1 in 6 women in the United States takes antidepressants. And a common side effect of those antidepressants is sexual dysfunction.
Sexual side effects can include different areas of sexual response, such as problems with desire, arousal, orgasm, pain, and general satisfaction.
That's a lot of problems.
Oh, boy.
Well, when it comes to side effects, not all antidepressants are the same. So it's important for women to be willing to talk with their doctor or their psychologist if they're having problems with their sexual function.
A paper being published in the September issue of Proceedings shares new research on antidepressants and sexual side effects for women. Here to discuss that article is co-author and Mayo Clinic psychologist Dr. Jordan Rulo. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Rulo.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That's right. We go right to the source. Dr.
That's
Rulo
right.
is one of the co-authors. So, Dr. Rulo, let me ask you. So, 126 or 225 million adult women in the United States. You divide that by 6, you get 21 million. And that's 15 to 20% of the population, females in this country, mm-hmm. are on antidepressants. Really?
Really.
Why?
Experiencing symptoms of depression.
Really? Do you think it's that common? So it didn't used to be that way, did it? A decade or two or three ago, what did women do before all these drugs came on the market that they advertise on TV and then they're prescribed for women in the country?
Just think about any mental health or medical concerns. What did we all do when the solutions weren't out there or treatments weren't out there?
Suffered through them.
Yeah.
A woman comes in and says, I feel depressed. Is that an indication to give her a drug, or are there some more objective criteria that you use before you would prescribe something?
There are criteria. So when we think about psychologists, there's the kind of the Bible for psychologists is called the DSM. Current DSM is the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Disorders. And in that DSM, there are a set number of criteria that someone would need to meet in order to get a diagnosis of depression. So some of the criteria are not having motivation, poor appetite, so eating less or eating more than typical, having a hard time getting out of bed, feeling sad more often throughout the day than not. So those are some of the symptoms. And if you meet a certain number of these criteria, then you get that diagnosis of depression. And you have to have those for at least 2 weeks. So this is something you're feeling for a couple weeks. I'll see patients where they say, yeah, you know, I felt that for a day last week. Well, that's not depression. That's just feeling emotions. Just
and do you think that antidepressants work?
They do, yes.
Okay.
And why do they hinder sexual satisfaction?
We believe that the main reason they cause sexual side effects is because of the change in neurotransmitters, the balance of neurotransmitters, specifically serotonin. So serotonin is a neurotransmitter that when there's more of it in your body, it's going to inhibit desire, arousal, orgasm. So we think it's because of the serotonin piece that really takes a hit on sexual function.
And are there any antidepressants that have less of an effect on sexual function? I mean, if it's a problem for a woman, I mean, do all of these drugs work the same way, in other words?
No, they don't all work the same way. There are several that have less sexual side effects. Wellbutrin or bupropion is one of them.
Well, that's the one they use to help people quit smoking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Same, and you use it for depression also.
Yes.
So is the paper that you published in the Proceedings, this is all about encouraging women to find other antidepressants, or what's it about?
So it's a concise review of the sexual side effects caused by antidepressants, and then what are some brief effective treatment options, ways to manage those sexual side effects. More often than not, women, both women and men, are experiencing sexual side effects with their antidepressant. They're not telling their physician. Their physician isn't asking. And then they're just stopping the medication because they're thinking, well, this is causing sexual side effects. I don't want to be on this. This isn't worth it. So they just stop taking the medication. They don't tell their doctor why they stopped. And then that was a treatment intervention that could have been helpful for them, but they're not doing it because of sexual side effects.
Yeah, if the sexual function takes a hit and you're depressed, and it's kind of a downward spiral.
Yeah. So what we're trying to say in this article is there is good research and relatively effective interventions that can help you manage those sexual side effects if you're having them, if you're not on antidepressants.
Such as?
Yeah.
Okay. It depends on, you know, what sexual side effects are you having. And you got to think about the different domains of sexual function. So is it low desire? Are you having a desire dysfunction? Are you having an arousal dysfunction? Are you having an orgasm dysfunction? Or is it impacting kind of overall sexual dysfunction? And based on the domain that you're experiencing a side effect in, then that determines the treatment protocol. Some of my favorite management strategies are for arousal. So difficulty with sexual arousal, there was a really neat study that looked at exercise for women who are on antidepressants who are having sexual arousal difficulties. And what they found, now I don't know how easy this is to do in real life, but what they found is if you do moderately intense exercise 3 times a week, preferably right before you have sex, that actually will help increase your sexual arousal. So this is for women who are on antidepressants.
That you said
right off the treadmill into the bedroom, huh?
If you can, right off the treadmill into the bedroom, it's going to help with that sexual arousal.
Well, the first one that you mentioned, though, was desire. What about that one?
Desire. So a few options. There are pharmacological options where you reduce the dose of your antidepressant. You can add on bupropion, Wellbutrin, onto your current regimen. So those are a couple pharmacological options. Behavioral options. There was one small study that showed that women just attempting sexual activity 3 times a week, just attempting, that actually increased their sexual desire.
Hmm. And what was the third one? Desire, arousal, and what was the third one?
Desire, arousal, and orgasm.
Okay, so what about that one?
One small study, again, this tiny study that looked at women using Viagra, and found that it actually helped a small number of women increase their orgasm with the use of Viagra. One thing that I recommend often as a psychologist is the use of a vibrator. Mm-hmm. So when we think about antidepressants, it's kind of like they put a kind of a wet blanket on your orgasmic capacity. So imagine if you're able to have much greater sexual stimulation, like with a genital vibrator, mm-hmm. that can actually kind of remove that wet blanket and help you reach that threshold to reach orgasm.
What about that new drug, flibanserin? Have you had any experience with that or any patients who have taken it? It seems like it didn't really take off like people expected it to lack of sexual desire.
Right.
Premenopausal women.
Oh. So the physicians that work in the women's health clinic where I'm at, I don't believe they have prescribed flibanserin even once so far. Wow. And flibanserin wouldn't be something you'd think about for, let's say, low desire for women on antidepressants. No research showing that it helps for a woman who's already on an antidepressant. It would be it's actually only approved for women who are not. So you wouldn't be thinking about flibanserin for what we're talking about here today. But you're right, flibanserin hasn't really taken off as many of us had kind of hoped, or at least as the pharmaceutical companies had hoped.
So the main takeaway is that there are options, and women need to be speaking with their physicians about them.
Yes, there are options. Tell your physician that you're experiencing sexual side effects. There are potentially pretty simple treatments.
All right, just one quick question. So we mentioned how common depression is in women. Is it similarly affecting as many men or no?
I don't have the statistic offhand, but I believe depression impacts women a bit more than it impacts men. And I think it's the way that women manifest. So women are going to look depressed where men might look a little bit more angry. And you're not going to see that as depression, although it might be.
And they're willing to tell their doctor about it, and the male may not be.
Exactly, exactly.
All right, Dr. Jordan Rulo, clinical psychologist, Mayo Clinic Rochester, talking about women, antidepressants, and sexual dysfunction. Great to have you on the program again.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll learn about diagnosis and treatment for underactive thyroid. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Hypothyroidism, or an underactive thyroid, it's a condition in which your thyroid gland does not produce enough of the hormones that it normally does. And the one I think everybody is familiar with is the thyroid hormone called thyroxine. Some 10 or 15 million Americans have hypothyroidism, and women, especially those over the age of 60, you're not even close, are most often affected.
Hypothyroidism upsets the normal balance of chemical reactions in your body. It seldom causes symptoms in the early stages, but over time, untreated hypothyroidism can cause a number of health problems, such as obesity, joint pain, and heart disease. The good news is diagnosis and treatment is safe, simple, and effective.
Well, if you go to an expert, that's for sure. When here to discuss hypothyroidism is a true expert, Mayo Clinic physician and former president of the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, Dr. Hossein Gharib. Dr. Gharib, great to have you on the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Is that pretty accurate? The literature would suggest there's at least 10 million people in America who have hypothyroidism?
Correct. I think that the estimates are 2.5% of the population has hypothyroidism.
So two or three people out of every 100.
Right.
Hypothyroid.
And in fact, what is even more impressive is that borderline hypothyroidism or subclinical disease is present in 10%. So if we go with small changes in thyroid function, that's even far more prevalent.
So subclinical, you mean that their thyroid is not working as well as it should, but they don't have enough symptoms that they've sought treatment.
That's partly true, or it's part of it is because the changes in thyroid function is minimal. Mm. It is not as advanced. Some patients do have symptoms.
Is it occurring more often, this hypothyroidism, or are you just getting better at detecting it?
That's it. Better tests, more sensitive tests, better detection, and more diagnosis.
So who is at particular risk? As I recall, more women than men have this condition, it's more likely to strike those who are older?
That's exactly right. Some risk factors include being a woman, older population, iodine deficiency, or certain drugs that we commonly use in practice.
So explain to us how an iodine deficiency, and where you might see that in the world, can lead to hypothyroidism.
Thankfully, the U.S. is not an iodine deficient country because of iodized salt that is used nationally. However, parts of the world there is iodine deficiency. Iodine is an important element for thyroid hormone synthesis and secretion. And so when iodine is not available in adequate quantities, thyroid gland works hard but does not produce enough hormones. As a result, patients become both hypothyroid and develop an enlarged thyroid or a goiter.
And again, that is hypothyroid is the underactive thyroid. But the hyper one is the overactive. Is that not as common?
Hyper is not as common.
Okay.
Although it is more complicated than hypo for diagnosis and treatment.
Oh, why is that?
Because it is a more complicated symptom complex.
Oh, it's trickier to track down?
It's trickier to treat. There are complications for treatment. There are complications for disease.
Gotcha.
Is this familial at all? If someone in your family has had hypothyroidism, are you more likely to get it?
The most common cause of hypothyroidism is autoimmune thyroid disease, which means the body fights against the thyroid. Mm. That then is a genetic predisposition. That's why more women are affected, and some families have predisposition to this condition. So you see some number of women in one family being affected. And the important item is that hyper and hypo, overactive and underactive thyroid, is the spectrum. So in some family members, you may have hyper, in another, hypo.
Wow.
Is thyroxine the one that we hear about and the one that the replacement hormone that people take if they do have hypothyroidism or they've had their thyroid removed, is that the only hormone that the thyroid gland produces?
Thyroxine was actually discovered, crystallized at Mayo 100 years ago by Dr. Kendall.
Really?
So historically, it's almost just a little bit more than 100 years ago, thyroxine was discovered. There are two thyroid hormones, thyroxine, or T4, and triiodothyronine, or T3. Both are secreted from the thyroid, although thyroxine is a more important element.
So you can replace the thyroxine, but you don't need to replace the other one?
Thyroxine changes, converts to T3 in peripheral tissue. So if I take thyroxine, my T3 comes from that thyroxine, ingest that thyroxine.
So it sounds like once you make the diagnosis, the treatment is relatively simple. You just have to give the patient thyroxine?
Exactly. And diagnosis is easy also. We have a thyroid stimulating hormone, or TSH, which is a reliable, sensitive test, widely available. If TSH goes up, hypothyroidism is diagnosed. And then once it is diagnosed, then treatment is with thyroxine, a hormone that has been present for more than 70 years in clinical practice.
I'm going to have to disagree a little bit, that it's relatively easy to treat, but it's not just straight out of the gate, because you have to figure out what level of thyroxine do you get to get those levels where they're supposed to be, because you can be too high or too low, and then you're hyper instead of hypo.
That is correct. You are right. In other words, we do replace thyroxine deficiency by administering thyroid, but some patients don't completely have alleviation of symptoms. Some remain mildly symptomatic. That's why there has been a recent advocacy for using both hormones in practice. So a combination of thyroxine and T3 or desiccated thyroid extract. Most professional endocrine societies do not support or recommend this practice, but there are advocacy groups and some patients who claim that they benefit from it.
Is that being studied to determine if it should be both?
It has been studied. There are reports on both sides of the issue.
All right, let's talk about symptoms. So if someone were hypothyroid, don't have enough thyroid hormone, what do they complain of? What do they feel like?
Symptoms are nonspecific. And so a lot of patients complain of fatigue, of weight issues, in women, menstrual irregularities, cold intolerance, constipation, musculoskeletal symptoms, things that are very nonspecific. There is a huge overlap between hypothyroidism and the population that has no thyroid condition but has similar symptoms.
Because this is as common as it is, and the symptoms can be many and varied, is it your recommendation or is it standard practice for, let's say, women over the age of 60 to get a thyroid hormone when they have their general exam?
Several of our groups, including our own organization, AACE, we have recommended screening with TSH in patients who are at high risk. For example, those who have other autoimmune disorders, family history of thyroid disease, or they are older than 60.
And so that TSH test is a thyroid stimulating hormone, and if you've got too much of that, it means that TSH is trying to stimulate the thyroid and it can't get the job done, and so it keeps going higher and
exactly.
higher. That's the key.
Exactly. The higher the number, the more likely your thyroid is profoundly deficient.
Can't you just check the thyroxine level itself?
You can. That is not as accurate or as sensitive as TSH. So TSH is the gold standard for thyroid function testing.
So we mentioned at the beginning that the age of 60 is when most women start to have trouble with this. Is that just something that should be added to a regular exam to just check that thyroid level?
It is a recommendation by several endocrine groups that TSH be checked as a screening test at age 60 or thereafter.
There you go. Symptoms, diagnosis, and treatment from one of the world's experts, Dr. Hossein Gharib, hypothyroidism. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
That's our program for this week.
Find more information on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Tweet your health and medicine questions to hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our writer and social media editor for the program is Jennifer O'Hara. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for joining us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.